This week, I'm joined by Theodore Dalrymple, who is a writer and retired prison doctor and psychiatrist. He has written multiple books, including Life at the Bottom, The World View That Makes the Underclass, and Spoilt Rotten, The Toxic Cult of Sentimentality. In this episode, we're going to discuss existentialism, meaning, responsibility, and his book, The Terror of Existence, From Ecclesiastes to the Theatre of the Absurd, which he co-authored with Kenneth Francis. If you wish to support Hermetics Podcast, please find links below for our Patreon and merchandise pages. Enjoy. Theodore Dalrymple, thank you very much for joining us on Hermetics.
You're welcome.
Okay. So just before we jump into the Hermetics question, if you could possibly give a, for the listeners who aren't familiar with your work or your life, which is very much entwined with your work, is there any possibility there you could give a brief overview of your path to where you...
Yes, well, I was a doctor. I'm retired now. I was a doctor who had worked and travelled extensively in the world. I crossed Africa by public transport, for example. But I latterly was a psychiatrist and a doctor in a prison and in an inner city hospital. And all these experiences have affected my writings and my work, as of course they would, really. So I used to have a, when I was quite a bit younger, a slight penchant for political danger. So I enjoyed going to civil wars. And then when I returned to England, I found I was horrified, really, by the level of social degradation and violence in everyday life in quite a large part of the British population or the English population.
Mm-hmm. What years was it when you left and when you made the return?
Well, I was in England on and off really most of my life, but I did spend about 4 years in Africa, 3 years in the South Seas, and about a year in Latin America. And I came back really more or less permanently in 1990, though I continued to travel quite a lot, and I would for example, under a different name, I wrote a book about peripheral communist countries, but they were short visits rather than lengthy stays, short visits to places like North Korea. So I've been based in Britain really since 1990, but continue to travel. Now I travel much less.
I think that's a clear enough overview for us to begin. So we begin with this question that's been devised specifically for this podcast, which is a way to kind of see what it is you're looking at the moment and the overarching questions in your thought. And we do this by the way of a question, which is, if you could place three thinkers, living or dead, within a room and listen in on the conversation, which three thinkers would you pick?
Well, it depends what you mean by thinkers, but I would quite like to listen to Dr. Johnson's view of the current situation. I would like to listen to Simon Lay's talking about current life, and I suppose I would like, I might like to hear Dickens as well. I don't know whether they count as thinkers. Certainly they thought a lot. I would like to hear them discuss our current travails. Simon Lees, I don't know whether how familiar people would be with Simon Lees, but he was a wonderful Belgian-Australian sinologist who, in the 1980s, was possibly the... Well, certainly he was the most famous sinologist to oppose, to describe the horrors of the Cultural Revolution, much to everyone's, the sinologists' disgust. And, of course, he was completely right. But as it happens, he was also an extremely good, in fact, the best that I know. He was an extremely good literary critic and essayist, and he had a wonderful way of condensing profundity in amusing and very short essays.
It's interesting that you've picked them for the purpose of analysing the present. A lot of people have picked historical thinkers so they could kind of pick their brains in terms of their thought in their own time. But when you mention our, as kind of an assumption there, of our contemporary travails, as you put it, what is that that you're alluding to there?
Well, I mean, all societies and all times have their travails, of course. And I think one of the things that strikes me about the modern world is the extreme contrast between our technical sophistication, our relative wealth, of course. It's unprecedented, really, that there should be no real hunger, that many, many people should be able to earn in an hour or two enough to eat for completely unprecedented. And yet there is this feeling that there is something profoundly wrong with the lack of meaning in life. I think these people would be interested in that and would have something illuminating to say about it.
What was the time that you see before we moved into this kind of, you know, meaningless contemporary society? What was the transition there? Was there a certain point where you started noticing, was it that first return to the UK, or was there other things you began to see?
Well, I began to think about it when I returned to Britain, and I saw people destroying themselves, destroying their lives for no external reason. I mean, I'd been to civil wars where, of course, I'd seen terrible things and absolute misery, but it seemed to come from outside, as it were. But in Britain, I saw people, a level of self-destruction, which I hadn't really thought about before. And I wondered how it had arisen, why it was there. And one of the questions I used to ask patients, and which produced quite a panic-stricken response, was, what are you interested in? A very simple question. And people found it a very difficult question to answer. And they would search around their minds for something to say. And quite a lot of them would end by saying, shopping. And, of course, I thought that wasn't really a very satisfactory answer. I mean, I would define contemporary shopping as I see it on Saturday in any large city in Britain as the insolvent in pursuit of the unnecessary. And this started me to think about the emptiness, actually, that people experience, and which, incidentally, quite interestingly to me anyway, is the theme of the contemporary French novelist Michel Houellebecq. I don't know whether everyone has, all the listeners have read him.
Submission and whatever, Atomized.
Yes. Yeah. Well, this kind of problem is his theme. Now, of course, he deals not necessarily with the people at the bottom of the social scale, but rather intellectuals and people without really any financial or other apparent difficulties. His theme is the apparent meaningless, the lack of transcendence of modern life. However, prosperous it appears.
Mm-hmm. You see Houellebecq as one of the best articulators of this kind of contemporary meaningless, is that?
I think he's very good. His books are, in a sense, limited because the theme is always the same, but he's very good at the variations on the theme, and he sees the absurdity of a great deal of modern existence. His protagonist is always the same kind of person. It's a well-educated man approaching middle age or middle age who has no financial problem and yet has a deep sense of meaninglessness, of drifting in the world.
Before I kind of ask the bigger questions on this meaning, on meaning in general, because they're the overarching large questions, I'll just kind of divert, because I did want to talk about your latest book, which is co-written with Kenneth Francis, called The Terror of Existence, Ecclesiastes to the Theatre of the Absurd.
Actually, may I just interrupt slightly and say this isn't my latest book, because my latest book is about the New England Journal of Medicine. It's a chronicle of the New England Journal of Medicine, which is one of the most important medical journals in the world, pointing out that it is full of errors and omissions, and in some cases political correctness. And I think this is a significant phenomenon. But anyway, return to the book, The Terror of Existence.
Okay, I do apologise. I checked a big bibliography. It clearly wasn't very... How recent is the other text?
The other book is was published in June this year.
Okay. And where could listeners purchase that, if they so wish?
Well, the same place as they would purchase Amazon. I regret to say the easiest place is Amazon, and I'm sure Waterstones and so on. But I think they are unlikely to find it in the shelves of their local bookshop. Mm-hmm.
So to return to the Terror
of Existence.
So to return to the Terror of Existence. A question to begin, which is quite a strange one, because this is a text which is a collection of essays on existential works, so thinkers such as Camus or Beckett, etc. And my question is, to collect these works in itself, and to write about them, and to try and find continually original ways of writing about them, do you not see that in itself as an existential task, because you're trying to find meaning in a collection of meaningless or texts which comment about the inherent meaninglessness of existence? Was there a strange kind of writing process going on there, or?
Well, my co-author, whom I've actually met only once, is strongly Catholic. So he has, if you like, a belief in a transcendent meaning to life and the universe and so on, which I don't have. So that is, I can't speak for him. For myself, I do think that having some kind of cultural activity, some kind of original, attempted original work in science or in art or in literature, in anything really, in history, in any cultural sphere, does help to keep the feeling of meaninglessness at bay. Of course, I may be deluding myself, but never, and therefore in that sense being dishonest, but no more dishonest than the authors of Vicky's work, because if you really believed the world was us and there was no point to anything, you wouldn't do anything. You wouldn't write the books for other people to write about. But nevertheless, I do feel that there's a kind of meaninglessness to existence, that one comes into the world, one goes out of it. The Kantian idea that one looks up in terror at the stars. One has great difficulty reconciling one's own self-importance with the complete insignificance of one's own life.
You mentioned just there that of course these authors have taken the time to write these books, and so if their position was entirely true, of course they wouldn't, because there'd be no point. So do you believe that as a position, nihilism, or to be a kind of active existentialist, isn't, that's not a possibility?
Well, I suppose you could say, well, you make your own purpose. Man is a purpose-making creature, just as he's a problem creator. He's not a problem-solving creature. He's a problem-making creature. But I think people do want something more than that. In the same way as, for example, when they make an aesthetic or a moral judgment, they don't just want to reflect, they don't want that moral or aesthetic judgment to be merely a statement about their own minds. They want it to be true. But where the truth of moral judgment or aesthetic judgment lies is a very difficult metaphysical question. I don't think anyone is truly a relativist. I don't think it's psychologically possible to be relativist. And yet when you try to justify or prove a moral or aesthetic judgment, I think it's, unless I've missed something in philosophy, it still puzzles people. I think there's a difference between saying, I find that beautiful, and that is beautiful. I don't think that we don't mean the same thing by those two sentences.
Do you think that existentialism, as it's kind of classically written, is making the mistake of assuming a position of kind of absolute truth? Or assuming a position wherein therein lies a possibility of absolute truth?
Well, I don't see again how one can escape the attraction of truth. It's inherent in our discourse, really, that we believe that we are enunciating or trying to enunciate a truth. And I don't see how one can escape that.
I found it interesting that your older work, which obviously deals with the underclass and Britain in a state of kind of degradation, that completely ties in with this text. And one of the things which you've written about time and time again, especially in Spoilt Rotten, was this connection between meaning and purpose and responsibility and, by and large, personal agency. Do you think that the kind of the clearest place where the people that you were treating at the time in the UK, where their meaning was lacking, that they simply couldn't take personal responsibility for their actions?
Well, if you look at the possible sources of meaning for people, one, of course, is the struggle for existence. If you have a real struggle for existence, then the question of meaning doesn't arise. You're just struggling to survive. And one of the attractions, actually, in my youth, or comparative youth, of danger was that when you're in danger, there are no other questions. The danger settles all questions for you, and the situation is so absorbing that no other questions arise. But anyway, there is no struggle for existence for most people. In fact, I once asked someone in the Netherlands, what would you have to do in the Netherlands to starve to death? Without deliberately trying to starve yourself, that is. And of course, it's impossible. You couldn't starve yourself to death in the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. So there's no struggle for existence can't give people any meaning or any success or any feeling of achievement. Then there's religious belief. And religious belief in Britain and France is almost dead. And irrespective of whether you're religious or not, the fact is it does give people a sense of meaning and transcendence. Then there's possibly political beliefs. Marxism is an obvious example, and whatever you think of Marxism, and I didn't think very much of it, but it does give people a sense of purpose and a sense of meaning. They are part of the, once they've accepted the doctrine and so on, they feel themselves to be part of a transcendent history, which has a teleology, as it were. But very few people now have any sense of a purpose like that. And one of the, they try to manufacture them, and there's a kind of balkanization of that purpose. So we have various kinds of fanaticism. But it's not, on the whole, that's not very convincing. Then there's artistic or scientific, philosophic endeavor. But this is really possible only for a very small proportion of the population. I don't know what proportion of the population, but a very small proportion of the population. And they don't really have any self-generated cultural activity. People are rather now passive recipients of cultural products. They don't participate in the way that Morris dancers used to participate, or they don't participate in anything else. So they don't have any of those possibilities of finding meaning. They don't really have any possible meaning in the continuation of their families, because there are no families. I mean, families are just associations of people that are more or less temporary. So what then is left? And actually, I came to the conclusion, this isn't a scientific conclusion, and people could say, well, I demand evidence for what you're saying, and I can't give you firm evidence. But I thought that quite a lot of social pathology arose from an attempt to fill a vacuum. It puzzled me why, for example, women often seem to like very, very bad men, and men who were obviously bad. I mean, you would know they were bad the moment they came through the door, and the women would admit that was so. And the fact is that they preferred a life of continual crises, self-generated, and miserable though it was, to a life which just went along in a flat, completely uninteresting way. They preferred being in a soap opera, even if it was a very unpleasant soap opera, to being just living, existing, maybe a bit more comfortably, without crises. Mm-hmm. So the crises gave a meaning to their life. And they, people did things which were quite obviously disastrous and self-destructive. And they knew in advance that they were disastrous and self-destructive.
And so that now is not so much our meaning, but the reaction people take in a world where it's nigh impossible to even, you know, kind of grasp onto the tiniest bit of meaning. So you just kind of, people are doing things for the sake of kind of thrill or some danger.
Yes, I think so. And that's why, of course, extreme sports are more common than ever before. And if you observe behavior in, at least this is in my field, and again, I can't prove it. If you wanted scientific proof, I couldn't give it to you. But when I observe the English enjoying, the young English people enjoying themselves and drinking themselves into oblivion, as it were, but in the meantime making a terrible nuisance of themselves, I see in their supposed enjoyment something almost hysterical. The screaming and laughing, which is almost an attempt to persuade themselves, this is how I interpret it, an attempt to persuade themselves that they're having a wonderful time rather than that they are having a wonderful time. And several times I've heard intelligent young people saying that they had a wonderful night last night, and the evidence that they had a wonderful night last night was that they can't remember anything about it, which is a rather dismal view of the possibilities of human enjoyment. And incidentally, in the days when the Daily Mail sent, I was briefly their vulgarity correspondent, as it were. There wasn't the official title, but that's what I was. And they would send me to places where young British people were gathering and behaving badly, which was almost everywhere where they were gathering. They sent me to Ibiza. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether you've ever been to Ibiza.
I haven't.
No. There are two giant nightclubs there. One is called Amnesia, and the other is called Manumission. And, of course, Manumission is being freed from slavery, and the other is forgetting. And it seems to and they are huge. I mean, they're not like nightclubs when I was a very young person, when the nightclubs were rooms where there were tables with pink tablecloths and people put round buckets with champagne in it and all that kind of thing. There was nothing like that. There were thousands and thousands of people. And it seemed to me that they were actually trying to forget themselves. And what they were forgetting, it seemed to me, was not the intolerability of their material existence, because by comparison with all other groups of people who have ever existed on Earth, they lived a comfortable existence. But the fact that they didn't know how to live or what to live for.
These nightclub kind of escapades and the culture of binge drinking and sort of unalloyed hedonism, this ties in with the idea that you have, which is a lot of these actions taken by the underclass or by the people in these positions, it is resentment.
Well, some of it's resentment. But incidentally, I don't really like the term underclass, because it implies that there's a group of people who are different from all the other people, shall we say 5% of the population, who behave in a completely different way from the rest of the population, and who are impoverished. Where people who go to Ibiza and go to these nightclubs and drink and so on are not impoverished. They're financially impoverished, I mean. And so I don't really like the term underclass, because I wasn't intending to write about a lumpen proletariat or anything like that. I was writing about contemporary British culture, which I think you can see absolutely everywhere you look. Yes, resentment. When I ask people, another very difficult question for people is, what would you do if you suddenly had a lot of money? Because if you say, I don't like my current life, and my current life is no good, what is it that would make your life better? And if you ask them, they may feel that there's economic injustice and so on. And if you say, well, you suddenly have a lot of money, what would you do? What would your life be like? And actually what you find, or what I found when I asked people that, was that what they wanted, what the only thing they could think of, actually, not that they particularly wanted it, was their current life, but on a more grandiose scale. So that they would drink more, or they would have a larger house, or they would go on an exotic holiday, or something like that. But actually, the fundamentals of their existence wouldn't change at all. They wouldn't know really what to do. And that's why, of course, many people who win the lottery are not gloriously happy for very long, because because they don't actually have anything that they really want to do or any way that they really want to live.
I'm right in saying that 70% of lottery winners become bankrupt within 5 years of winning. So I think yes. That's kind of a...
Of course, you could say what happens to the other 30%. I don't know. But certainly, I mean, that was the thing that struck me very much was that all they would do is live their current life, but on a slightly bigger scale of consumption. That's all they could think of.
And that ties into the other difficult question you were asking your patients, which they often replied, you know, shopping. And it seems that consumption then is the closest we're getting to at least a clear way of articulating what meaning is in I don't want to use the word underclass, but I was using that just to group the
people. Well, one of my books has a subtitle about the underclass. It wasn't of my choosing. As I said, I don't really like the concept actually. But anyway, go on. Yes.
Yeah. So consumption. Do you see any from a psychological point of view? Do you see any specific reason that consumption is so meaningful to people, or is it really just an empty kind of activity which just gives you dopamine?
Well, I don't want to pose as a kind of ascetic who lives on locusts and honey in the Syrian desert, because that would be ridiculous. I'm not extremely rich, but I'm not extremely poor either, and I have no desire to be poor. I like physical comfort, and I like good food, and so on and so forth. So I'm not posing as one of the fathers of the church who was completely indifferent to material consumption. But on the other hand, I certainly haven't made it the focus of my existence. So I'm not completely indifferent to material well-being. But that's not quite the same as spending your spare time looking for things which actually won't make you any happier. And this is a problem from top to bottom of society. It's not just people at the lower level. I was once in Beverly Hills in California, and I observed people who are obviously extremely rich going into very, very expensive and exclusive shops and department stores, and they had the most miserable faces. And they came out and they were miserable. And they came out with things which presumably they must have wanted, at least for a few seconds or possibly a few minutes. But the idea that this would actually bring them any meaning or give them any purpose was preposterous. And actually, insofar as there is meaning or purpose in what they were doing, it was to find fault with what they purchased and with what they had, in the hope that buying something else would provide the meaning that they hadn't found in whatever they'd bought before.
This all kind of strangely ties together in that, you know, Ibiza and these groups of people just kind of being pulled into what sounds to me like a sort of hell, to be quite honest, these nightclubs, and being kind of just pulled by these, I guess you could say, forces, the same with consumption and shopping. And this ties in with one of the, I guess, the more controversial things you've written. Of course, there is many. But the idea of the knife went in, which is, of course, some of your people that you dealt with in psychiatric hospitals, when they'd stabbed people, they didn't kind of admit to any personal agency. They stated it in the way that the knife went in, as if at least if I was to read that in at least some sort of metaphorical way, I'd say that I could see that as a statement that it's almost as if the culture that's taken the person with it is in charge, in the same way that these people who consume all the time, it seems that all personal agency is out the window, and we're actually being controlled by the material.
Yes, well, I think we all I think we all do it to some extent. I would be very surprised if you've never blamed forces outside yourself for your own failings, because I've certainly done that, and I think most people do it at some time. The question is to what extent they do it, and whether they ever bethink themselves so that they stop doing it. The knife went in is an interesting example, and it, actually what I discovered was that almost every person who stabbed someone to death, at least in the prison in which I worked, put it that way when asked what happened. They say the knife went in as if the knife were the agent and the hand did not guide the knife guided the hand, as it were. But this put them in an odd psychological position, because, of course, at some level, they knew, of course, that this was perfectly absurd. They knew it was not so. And yet, in a certain way, they were given rewards for alleging that they were not agents, but the vector of forces, as it were. And this is perhaps a more important example is that of addiction, particularly addiction to heroin, which became very prevalent while I was working. And people would, if asked, why did you start taking heroin, people would say, I fell in with the wrong crowd, as if there were a form of social gravity. But when you actually analyze what was necessary for them to become an addict, what you find is that most such addicts took heroin on and off for about 18 months before they became physically addicted. They had to learn where to get the heroin. They had to learn how to prepare it. They had to learn how to inject it. And actually injecting yourself with something is not a pleasant thing to have to learn, and most people would have an inhibition against it. So you have to overcome an inhibition in order to do it. They have to learn to disregard the unpleasant side effects of heroin. And yet they presented themselves as if their addiction was something that happened to them rather than something that they did. And unfortunately, the medical profession and other professions have reinforced that by claiming that addiction is simply a physiological condition that just happens to you, rather like Parkinson's disease or rheumatoid arthritis. That's what happens to you. You get addicted, and it comes out of the blue. And this is nonsense. And it's dangerous nonsense, because it disguises from the person his own agency, and also prevents him from taking agency, which is the only way he will overcome his addiction. And many patients, for example, said to me, I would stop if I got the help. In other words, and what they meant by the help was that there was some technical treatment, some technical maneuver or procedure which would stop them taking the drug without them having to decide anything. The doctor could just stop it for him. And this, it seemed to me, not only was it not true empirically, but it was complete philosophical nonsense.
So this idea that they almost revel and enjoy being the most downtrodden and the most, almost the most kind of cosmically unlucky, and it seems that, especially in Spoilt Rotten, you wrote about this a lot, that people will actually go to extreme lengths to not only prove that they're sort of extremely downtrodden, but they will almost exacerbate it. Do you think this is they purposefully exacerbate their bad luck, or is it subconscious almost desire to seem that way?
Well, I suppose there's a kind of romanticism to it. As you were talking, I thought of a particular prisoner, whom of course I can't name, but whose goal in life was to be the worst and most difficult prisoner in the British or English prison system. And he was indeed extremely difficult, and so difficult that he was sent from prison to prison. No prison would take him for longer than 2 weeks, because he made himself too difficult. And that was a kind of goal he set himself because he wanted to distinguish himself. And he couldn't distinguish himself in any worthwhile sphere that, at any rate, most people would consider worthwhile. So he distinguished himself in a way which was completely worthless. But he was at least distinguished. He was not just going to work 9 to 5, leading an ordinary life, an obscure life of quiet desperation. He did become important in a kind of way. And I reflected also on phenomena such as tattooing, which I noticed. I think I was quite relatively quick to notice that tattooing was ascending the social scale. At one time, tattooing a tattooed person was almost declaring his own marginality. He was either, he might be a sailor, in which case that was more or less socially acceptable. Most criminals were tattooed. But then it started ascending the social scale, and now it's reached the point where I think something like 30% of British adults are tattooed, and in certain age groups it's probably more than that. And this is quite sudden. And I wondered, what on earth did it mean? This sudden, it's more than just a fashion. It's more than a tie being thin or wide or brightly colored or very sober. It's something much more important than that. And I wondered what it actually meant. And initially, my initial theory, I read a book by a woman called E. Mello, I think, called Bodies of Inscription. And she said that people were trying to express themselves and be individual by tattooing themselves. And I dare say there's something in that. Though if that's your way of expressing yourself, I would say you don't have much to express. But anyway, I thought there was still, at the time, there was still something antinomian about it. It was a kind of act of rebellion, but at the same time, it was joining a group. So you were both trying to individuate yourself and be a member of a group at the same time. And also, at that time, I thought it was an expression of supposed political virtue, in as much as you were identifying with marginal people who were assumed to be downtrodden and unjustly treated because they were marginal and generally impoverished. So I think there was a kind of attraction, if you like, a nostalgie de la boue involved, and there still is. If I were to say that you were a respectable person, you were probably respectable in the old-fashioned sense that you went to work, that you did your work, that you caused nobody any problem, that you kept yourself clean, and so on and so forth, had no criminal record, had no outstanding characteristics almost, you would take it not as a compliment, but as an insult.
Because people wish to be seen as kind of dangerous and obscure.
Well, certainly outstanding in some way. There's not much not much satisfaction in leading an ordinary, useful, but not outstanding life. And one of the things I've noticed is that one of the characteristics of our time, I think, is ambitious mediocrity. Now, there's nothing wrong with mediocrity. We need mediocrity. Not everybody can be outstanding, and everyone is mediocre in much of what he does. There are very few people who are outstanding in every department of human existence. And so there's nothing wrong with mediocrity. What is awful is ambitious mediocrity. And I see an awful lot of that, which I don't remember. Earlier, I saw a lot in hospitals and in administration and in power grabbing. Power has become a very, very important thing, possibly because of a lack of meaning, actually. People feel powerlessness much more acutely than they used to. And power, the achieving of some kind of power, can give a meaning to life.
And by ambitious mediocrity, do you mean people striving to be almost seen as, say, you know, they are
powerful or important,
extrovertly showing that they're in on it. You know, they've got the tattoos, they've got the trinkets and luxuries of society.
Well, there is that, yes. But there's also the exercise of power in bureaucracies and so forth and hierarchies. Often, oddly enough, in the name of equality. But certainly one sees, well, I thought I saw a lot of people who were very ambitious, but actually had no particular talent or ability.
Do you think that that then kind of almost false or pseudo ambition, do you think that kind of came from people consuming too much dramatic TV and believing that everyone can be this kind of...
Well, it's possible, I suppose. It's possible, but I think destruction of religion, the evaporation of religion, has quite a lot to do with it.
It's interesting that you said earlier on that Britain isn't really a religious country. I mean, a lot of people are, at least where I am, perhaps I'm in a fairly privileged area, I guess. But I haven't seen much. People still seem to be going to church and practicing religion. But is this then not in the same way as it was before? This is more of a facade.
Well, my guess is that you're living in a part of the country which is not at all typical. I think Britain is an extremely irreligious country. I'm not a religious person. I have no religious belief myself, and I certainly don't want to live in a theocracy. But I think what you're describing is a small, probably fairly uniform town, but it's certainly not typical of Britain as a whole. And if you go to Wales, for example, Wales used to be a country where there was what to me seemed a rather dismal non-conformist religion, which was perhaps full of hypocrisy and seemed to me horrible in many ways. But on the other hand, it did give a meaning to life, and it's collapsed completely. And you see this in physically, in the sense that all the chapels now, none of the chapel, and there are hundreds of chapels, possibly thousands of chapels in Wales, none of them is still a chapel. They're all luxury apartments. All apartments in Britain are now luxury apartments, however small and dismal they are. And or they're pharmacies or nightclubs, but they're not chapels. And no one goes to chapel anymore. And it's what held that society together in many ways an undesirable fashion. And I would have hated it. Nevertheless, it's what gave that society its peculiar savour, its unity, It also gave people something to struggle against, something worth struggling against. Now it's just it's a society which believes in absolutely nothing except trying to have a good time, and they're not even very good at that. You see people shopping. You see, I mean, this is not just Wales, I'm talking about the whole country. You see people endlessly shopping for clothes. When do you ever see anybody well-dressed? Practically never.
What do you make, then, of at least as I see it, is this the past kind of perhaps 30 to 40 years of self-help which has been targeted towards happiness as a almost... I don't know, I can't really describe, but the goal, which is just seems to be beyond every cafe and every advert and every piece of media, almost has as its teleology that happiness is that which we should be striving towards, yet no one can really define it. As a psychologist, did you see this announce itself, or what do you make of it?
Well, certainly one... It's certainly true if you ask people what they want to do or what they want to be, they'll say, I want to be happy. And, of course, I would say, you know, when they said that, I said, well, that's not an ambition. Happiness is, first of all, you mainly know that you're happy in retrospect, that's first. And secondly, it's a byproduct of something else. It's not that... you say, now I'm going to try and be happy. And you think, well, if I take these pills, I will be happy. That seems a very reduced idea of a proper goal. And it's impossible. You can't aim at being happy. You can only aim at... And I used to tell people that they shouldn't try and... find themselves, they should try and lose themselves. In losing yourself is happiness, not in finding yourself.
What's the difference there between finding oneself and losing oneself?
Well, losing oneself is being absorbed in something that you believe to be worthwhile, and in a sense it doesn't really matter what it is. It's difficult to justify scholarship in some obscure corner of human knowledge rather than, say, I don't know what, gardening or any other thing. But anyway, what you've got to do is lose this sense of yourself, and which is much harder to do. And patients would say, well, how do I do that? And this was the problem, my problem. I don't really know how one goes about it. All I can say is that in my life I've been very interested in many different things. I've been a kind of serial monomaniac, if you like. But how you actually start becoming interested in it, if you've no idea of how to get interested in anything, it's very difficult to know how to advise someone. And I think this is something that presumably is done early in childhood, just as I believe it's probable that if a child doesn't learn how to concentrate by a certain age, it probably will never learn to concentrate. And in the same way, if you don't learn how to lose yourself in something that is larger than yourself, if you don't learn that fairly early in life, you will probably never learn it. And you know, how do you explain to someone who actually knows very little and who doesn't look around him and who has all these distractions available to him, such as vast television screens everywhere and so on? How do you explain to him how to lose himself?
Yeah,
I wish I knew.
it's almost teaching someone how to learn, but very late in their lives, extremely difficult feat. So we're getting on for an hour now, so we could begin to wrap this up. But there's certain elements of the kind of current political situation that I'd like to mention in terms of Obviously, a lot of, should we just say, right-wing thinkers. I mean, Roger Scruton is the latest example of being deplatformed. And obviously, I don't know if you have your own definition of where you are politically, or a specific definition, but would I be right in saying that you are right-wing?
Well, it depends what you mean by right-wing. I try not to define myself too much ideologically, because once you're put in a certain place, you're expected to have certain ideas, and not to think about things independently. It is rather alarming that people, it seems to me now, paint themselves or are painted into corners. And it does seem that we all are beginning to live in little islands of like-minded people. There's a book in France called L'Archipel Français, in which he says that people of like minds, like education, like tastes, are increasingly surrounded by people just like themselves, and they know nobody outside that kind of milieu. And I mean, not long ago I was having a conversation with someone, a very cultivated, a nice, intelligent, cultivated person, who said, almost with pride, that he didn't know anyone who voted for Brexit. Now, this, and as I said, was almost proud of not knowing anybody like that, as if people who voted for Brexit had some kind of infectious disease. And this seemed to me a very bad sign, that one could be proud of not knowing any single person of 52% of the electorate that voted in one way. I would never say that.
It seems almost...
I mean, it wouldn't be true. It wouldn't be true in my case anyway. It wouldn't be true. But I would never say such a thing. It would strike me as a disaster if it were actually true.
Do you, this is what I was going to ask you. In your position as someone who, could I say, an iconoclast in terms of politics, how have you seen the changes, has there been any effect on your work come from this kind of recent strange form of leftism that we're seeing?
No, I mean, I can only say that I haven't. I certainly haven't suffered the kind of abuse that Roger Scruton has suffered, actually more or less throughout his career, from the very beginning. I haven't suffered anything like that, possibly because nobody's taken any notice of me. I haven't been important enough to abuse, but I can't say I've suffered any kind of abuse or anything like that. I do view with alarm the increasing hatred that people of different opinions seem to have for one another, as if the only thing that counted in a person's personality or character was his opinion. So that you take someone of a differing opinion as being not merely of a different opinion, but as a bad person or even evil. Person, or necessarily ignorant and stupid. I mean, there's a temptation to do that, of course, but it's a temptation that should be resisted. And if you want to live in a free society, you have to recognize that people are of different opinions and maybe very virtuous and good people without necessarily sharing your opinion. But I think that's increasingly rare.
Yeah. You mentioned evil there, and actually you write in The Terror of Existence that the exposure of evil is a transcendent goal. Do you think this ties in? Perhaps this is what the left is doing. They wish to kind of expose all evil so they can finally have their kind of blank slate of pure...
Well, I think, one of the one of the problems of utopianism, if you like, or of expecting too much from politics is an absence of the a sense of the tragic dimension of human life and an inability to recognize that we are complex creatures whose desires are contradictory, and therefore we cannot have a perfectly satisfactory life. This is the theme of Dr. Johnson's book, Rasselas, that there is no perfect life for man, and that dissatisfaction is the permanent condition of man. And that sounds, at first sight, that sounds pessimistic, but actually it's consolatory, because it helps you to put your dissatisfactions into some kind of perspective. And you know that actually what you want several things, but they are not compatible. And therefore you will always be, to an extent, dissatisfied. And that is something that I think people are quite unaware of, or don't wish to acknowledge.
So people need to read more Stoicism and understand that suffering is not only a part of life, but actually a key part of life.
And it's necessary, and it's an individual instance of suffering is perhaps avoidable and should be assuaged wherever it is possible. But the idea that there can be a life without suffering is absurd.
That seems to be where the left's target is towards such a life. But I mean, of course, that's nothing new. That's generally Marxism, once again, you know, targeting towards the utopian dream of.
But any form of utopianism, yeah. Whatever it is, doesn't recognize this, if you like, this. I don't know whether it's a flaw in man's nature, but it exists in man's nature and can't really be overcome. So that on the one hand you'll want excitement, but on the other hand you want security and safety, and these two things aren't really compatible.
So unless there's anything else you'd like to add or something that I've commented on that I've quickly gone over, I think that's a good place to wrap this up.
No, I think that. Thank you very much.